Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
So let's just start off with a few brief stories, and I want to just tell you about my favorite animal and why this tiny little thing may be becoming very important in coming years. And we're talking about the water bear, also called the moss piglet, but the technical term is tardigrade. Tardigrade are very, very small animals, multicellular animals that live in moss. Would you be surprised? Well, not just moss, actually. They've been found at the depths of the ocean in vents. They've been found on the slopes of volcanoes. And they've even managed to survive being in the Arctic. Yes, these are resilient little buggers. That's why they're my favorite. They can survive enough radiation, something that could be hundreds of times greater than would kill a human. Yet they didn't evolve living in nuclear reactors. They can survive vacuum, but they didn't evolve in vacuum. And they can survive desiccation in the desert and be rehydrated. Are you ready for this? 50 years later, and they wake up, start moving around, and even are able to breed. Well, would you believe scientists have been studying it at the molecular level, trying to figure out, hey, what is up with this critter? And they have discovered something very interesting about the tardigrade. They are experts at molecular repair. They can have their DNA shattered into tiny pieces and put that puzzle back together before the next cell division, thus avoiding, well, cancer, among other things. Now, in us, in any single one of our cells, about 40 times a day, a strand of DNA is broken or damaged by a cosmic ray or oxidative stress. And each time that happens, the cell has to fix those breakages. And it does that by making repair proteins, which walk around like guards and look for errors and stray bits of nucleotide waving in the breeze where they shouldn't be. And what the tardigrade does is it produces vast amounts of these proteins and a high enough level that even high-dose radiation can't permanently damage their DNA and kill them. They're really small, like I said, about a half a millimeter in length, and no one knows why they evolved this. But researchers are now studying their special repair proteins to try and see if it yields any useful insights for the prevention of cancer. And also, you know, thinking ahead, when we have a Mars colony, they're going to need some of this tardigrade protein CRISPRed into their DNA to be able to actually function without getting cancer out there without that lovely magnetic field that has been giving us such a beautiful light show and showing off its fabulous superpowers to keep us from being showered with toxic levels of solar radiation. Yes, the magnetosphere has been putting on a show, and unfortunately, Mars doesn't have one. I've got a call. I'm going to pick that up. Hello, it's Dr. Dawn. You're on the air.
Oh.
Hi there. You got right on. What can I do for you?
Oh, thank you so much. Yes, hi, Dr. Dawn. My name is Sarah, and I'm calling about a medical issue that I'm dealing with and would like to ask you about.
Love to hear it.
Okay, I'll give you a little background. And when I was 2 years old, I had a hernia, double hernia surgery. At 53 years old, I had no problems with it. I experienced a blockage and then surgery in the lower digestive area. And they found a little benign kind of growth and they took it out. And I've never had any problems since then until I last summer had a knee replacement and took oxycodone and Tramadol and some of the stronger drugs that they give you for the first 3 days. And was afraid to go off of them as I'd kind of planned, but I didn't really have a plan because it's new to me. And it put my digestive tract to sleep,
mm-hmm.
and eating slowed down almost completely. And by the third week, the blockage occurred, and very, you know, I couldn't eat anything, and I was losing a lot of weight. Went to emergency and had a second surgery 3 weeks after the knee surgery, and I was told that the scar tissue had grown back from the two prior surgeries as a baby, and then also at 53. So I'm doing well with that, but now I'm going in for a second knee replacement. Feel pretty good and strong enough to do that, but my concern is the medications, how to handle them. I've been given the idea of alternating between Tylenol and Advil, and from some people who found that to work, but I don't know a lot about it yet. And I'm also really wanting to take good care of myself, general support in daily life with this problem that has only shown up a few times, but enough to really cause trouble. And then I'd also like to know how to take care of myself pre-op with food and preparation, and after the surgery as well with both food and medicine. So that's what I'm looking at. I've been trying to do research, and I luckily called the station about a question and ended up talking to a lovely man that told me you were on the air tonight. So here I am. So, yeah, I'd love to hear anything that you have to say.
Well, let me start with commiserating with you, because small bowel, bowel obstructions are just no fun at all. And
right.
They are, and unfortunately, one of the characteristics of the intestines, first of all, you've got a bag that's the mucosa. It's basically kind of similar to the lining of your throat or your esophagus.
Uh-huh.
And that lines the inside of your abdominal wall, right up against the wall. And
okay.
So that's the first level of coating, if you will. And on top of that, you've got the stomach and the intestines, and all of that is coated with a second layer of tissue. And these tissues are designed to slide against each other. So everything's covered with this slippery mucosa. And you know how when you get a cold sore inside your mouth, and it's sore, it hurts when you drink, you know, something salty or vinegary.
Mm-hmm.
But also, when you feel it with your tongue, it's rough, right?
Mm-hmm.
It has a rough texture. Well, the mucosa is this kind of soft, velvety stuff. So the peritoneum, it's called, is just very slidey and slippery. But when it becomes inflamed and irritated, it gets sticky. It becomes more like Velcro. And
Wow. So
you end up with a tangle if this, and unfortunately, whenever we operate within the abdomen, we create irritation and inflammation because, you know, we're causing that whole inflammatory cascade with the, you know, ending up with the prostaglandins and start, you know, and all the interleukins kind of come in, join the party, and they all get drunk and wreck the place. And then somebody comes in and cleans it all up. But it's really common with abdominal surgery that a few pieces stay Velcroed together and heal that way. And so now you've got a potential place where stuff, like a hairpin turn, where stuff can get stuck. And sometimes it'll even twist on itself, and that can be dangerous. That could actually cause intestinal gangrene, but it's rare. So we're not going to worry about that.
Okay.
However, your obstruction at 50 was probably related to scar tissue that's been in there and not causing any problem, and then just zigged when it should have zagged and got to, and you got a blockage. And so
also that I didn't add in, but I will do that now, that I had been losing weight and gaining it a little and losing it probably about 5 months before the surgery, along with panic attacks. And I have a history that maybe is related to that and maybe not. So in all fairness, I think that something was going on with the bowel system already, because I was not wanting to eat. And I think that just blew it out of the room, you know.
So, you probably slowed your motility. And stress will do that. When we get into fight or flight,
oh.
we We tend to slow down our peristaltic waves because the intestine kind of looks like an earthworm with those rings of muscle contraction that you see.
Uh-huh.
Well, you're doing that. Those are called peristaltic waves, and they push the food along and push the food around the corners and push the food down and eventually push the food out. And, you know, we've all had this sensation when we have a stomach flu or something like that, where the peristalsis kicks up and it's going too fast, and we get these sudden, oh my God, where's the toilet kind of moments. And so, but the opposite can happen, and that's also a pathology. You know, it's very much a Goldilocks phenomenon, not too, you know, too much, not enough, or just right.
Yeah, okay.
And so so now comes the next event, which is, of course, opiates. Opiates are notorious for slowing down peristalsis.
Yeah, I found that out.
Opiate receptors in the gut. And so I will say that that's one of the reasons to use as few as possible. But, and I'll come to my advice when I finish my discursive discussion here, which I'm I'm almost there. Anyway, your second GI surgery broke up whatever attachments were there, but it also irritated the peritoneum again. And so now the chance to form new Velcro patches that stick together is excellent. And that's probably why when you had your GI surgery and you took the opiates and you slowed down your motility, you had a chance for basically the train cars to stack up on the curve, and it just stopped. And that can, unfortunately, another surgery, not great. So your risk is actually even higher than it was before. So I did want to tell you about, there's one drug approved in the United States that's designed to treat opioid-induced constipation. And so you can also, and so there's a couple of other things. It's called naloxegol, and it basically doesn't get into your system. It just sits in your gut and prevents the opiates from hitting the opiate receptors in the gut. So you don't get the slowdown. It's very expensive, and last I checked, but it's been around for a while, and it may have gone generic. But I would talk to my doctor about that, because I do think you're high risk. And this is something that your orthopedic surgeon probably doesn't know about. Your gastrointestinal, your GI surgeon does.
Right.
But you could, so I'm going to spell it for you. So get a pen. I'll spell it in a minute.
Okay.
First of all, the trade name, which is cute. So I like cute trade names. Movantik, like M-O-V-A-N-T-I-K. So that's
Movantik.
But its chemical name is naloxegol, which you may think, gee, that sounds a lot like naloxone. And indeed it does, because it's closely chemically related and it blocks the opiate receptor.
And I don't know what that is, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, chemicals are shapes, right? These molecules are complex shapes, and they act like a key in a door. And you know how sometimes a key is a little bit off, but you can kind of, you know, shake it and jimmy it a little bit and get the lock. So that's the kind of thing that's going on with these molecules that get into the opiate receptor, but then they sit there for a while, and so the opiates can't get into the lock. Kind of like bubblegum in a keyhole. So right. So there's also another strategy which may be cheaper. I don't actually know. This one is where you take naltrexone, which is the drug that's in Narcan, and they have a subcutaneous, you can just basically shoot up naltrexone, which is kind of weird.
Do you spell that?
Methyl, methylnaltrexone. The nice thing about this one is that you could have like one or two doses around. And if you start to stop up, you could use it. And the worst thing that would happen would be that you would get diarrhea. But it works quickly. It takes about 4 hours.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
So it can, these are typically used in cancer patients who have, or other people with long-lasting pain who are going to need to use opiates, and that's just going to happen. And we're trying to work with it. There are a number of other medications. If you look up opiate-induced constipation on a browser, you'll see a bunch of them. And some of them work through the opiate blocking mechanism. There are other mechanisms. There's one actually that is, you've heard of cholera, the disease that gives you diarrhea, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this one is sort of cholera light. It's the molecule that cholera, the toxin that cholera excretes is a molecule, has a shape, and prevents reabsorption of fluid from the gut. So what this is sort of a kinder, gentler version of this toxin, and it's also very good for, you know, intractable constipation. But the thing is, you're going to have to keep the cars moving down the track.
So that's that
a curve in the road ahead. So other things that you can do that are probably cheaper and more natural is, first of all, get on enough magnesium.
Magnesium citrate that I've been using a lot of.
And figure out the dose that gives you like 2 or 3 applesauce stools a day.
So applesauce.
Yeah, like a big pile of applesauce in the toilet.
Okay.
So sorry for those of you who are eating dinner, but hopefully you're not having applesauce. Anyway, just, you know, the consistency and the texture. You want to learn what dose does that. And there's probably about a 24-hour to a 36-hour latency between that dose of magnesium and the effects. But once you figure it out, you're going in forewarned and forearmed. So you can use your magnesium dose. As soon as you're on the opiates, just start taking that much magnesium, keep taking it, and try to dance with the whole thing and get off the opiates as soon as you can. We see that early mobilization, you know, we drug you up, we get you up on your hind legs, and we get you walking, drastically reduces the amount of opiate pain medication that's required.
Oh, okay. They did that with me, and I was pretty much up for it. So
be up for it again, because you want to avoid yet another surgery.
Yeah, definitely.
So lots of fiber, keep things moving.
And when people say fiber, I'm confused these days, because it seems like there's
soluble fiber
and
non-soluble fiber.
I'm very confused about it.
All right. Well, basically, eat a lot of vegetables, particularly root vegetables. Those are very good for your microbiome, so that'll help get things up and balanced. I recommend they're going to give you antibiotics at the time of the surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Even when they're doing a joint replacement, you will get a big dose of antibiotics, and it's going to mess with your microbiome. So build the microbiome up before you hit it, and then as soon as you're out the door of the hospital, start taking about 50 billion, that's billion with a B, mixed bacteria. I'm going to name a name. There's a product called Jarrowdophilus, J-A-R-R-O-W. That's one that is available widely. Look at the back. I think it's one capsule twice a day would be the 50 billion twice a day. But
50 billion. Yeah. I have something like that.
Yeah, check the dose. Yes, check the dose. And the thing is, good bacteria really work. And you want to, these will not take root. They're decorative, but they do the job while you're taking them. And then your own microbiome will come back and reassert itself. And maybe you'll find that you're more regular and things are going easier and stay on them then. But you could drop the dose down to maybe 25 or 50 rather than staying at 100 billion in a 24-hour period.
Okay, oh, that's really good. Okay, and root vegetables would be what? I've been told not to eat them, and then I've been told, you know, and so I'm listening to what you're saying and wondering which ones you mean.
Okay, root vegetables. We got your turnips. We got your rutabagas. We got your carrots. We got your beets. We got your parsnips.
Okay. I got it.
You got, what have I left? Oh, yams, sweet potatoes.
Oh, okay.
You know, I have to do a song. I'll have to talk to Rachel and have her help me write the music, and we'll do a song all about root vegetables. We're rooting for the microbiome here.
Okay, so for the 50 billion Jarrowdophilus to conquer the antibiotics.
Right. And then
you said that I'm at risk. I mean, does this mean I'm going to be dealing with this the rest of my life in a big way?
Well, it means that I don't, you know, I left my crystal ball at home. But,
oh, darn.
But I would say you have a constitutional vulnerability that you need to address.
Yeah, okay.
And so it's kind of like having the, you know, that there's your house is built and it's always the left side that floods when it rains, you know.
Yeah.
It's still a good house. Just got this vulnerability. And as soon as it rains, you get out there with the sandbags and you try to prevent it. And that's what we're talking about, prevention.
Okay. Well, that's really, really helpful. Yeah. And any other foods you would suggest that are
fruits and vegetables?
Fruits and vegetables.
Yeah. Whole grains, you know, but grains, right? So we're talking wild rice, we're talking quinoa, you know, stuff that has a granular granular texture and hasn't been reduced to some kind of powder that you mix with things and cook.
Right. And what about on the market stuff, like somebody recommended some, you can't say anything probably about that, but I did try some of those and they seem to not do anything. So, but I don't need them right now. I've been doing just the calcium, magnesium. Yeah. So
real food.
I mean the manganese.
Yes. Yeah. Magnesium. Yes. All right. Very good, Sarah. Bye for now.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it very much.
Bye. Okay, caller number two, you're on the air. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hello, Dr. Dawn.
Hello.
This is Jane from Pacific Grove.
Hello.
Okay, you got a tough one here.
Okay.
I have a dislocated cataract lens replacement after 7 years. Yes. So, it's very rare, and I went to the ophthalmologist, and he gave he said, what he does for it is tough for him. He gave me a second referral, and I went to Stanford, and he does different. And he said, that's all right, go for him. But this is my thing. After I saw my doctor recently, he came up with another solution. Are you ready?
I'm waiting.
Okay. My lens is dislocated. He said I could go to an optometrist and get a contact lens.
Uh-huh. Yes.
I've looked that up on the internet and I'm going, you're going to leave my dislocated lens there. And I go to an optometrist and he's going to give me a contact lens. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that I would call that conservative management. And,
well, I like it.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so you've got this little loose foreign body.
Yes.
This is the technical term for this, floating around in your eyeball, minding its own business, floating around. Maybe it will, can you see it? Like, do you have a line across your visual axis, or has it totally gotten?
I did, but it's moved, and I all I see now is a blur.
Right, because you have no focusing ability. So I would certainly go for, if it were me, I would go for the lens. I mean, I would go for the contact lens and see what kind of vision restoration I can get.
Wow.
I think that, yes, they can go.
I love your answer, because I looked it up on the internet and all I saw were ophthalmologists' answers for getting an operation. I have saw nothing them saying that that's a possibility, but my doctor did, and I thought, are you really, really sure about, can I do that?
Well, okay. So I am not, I want to state for the record that I am not an ophthalmologist.
Oh,
but, okay. But I am also going to state is my opinion, you know, you say the saying you hear lately, haters gonna hate. Well, surgeon's going to cut. And so they will go for the invasive option more often than perhaps they should. And I'm not speaking for all cases, but it's kind of like you either make, as my husband likes to say, you can either make a type one or a type two error. You can treat everybody as guilty and you'll be wrong some of the time and right some of the time, or you can make the other and treat nobody as guilty and you'll be wrong some of the time and right some of the time. So I have a bias towards conservative management unless it's not working out or there's some overwhelming reason not to do it. And I have not studied the complications of just letting sleeping lenses lie. And
that's
so
funny.
that's what I would research now is complications of displaced intraocular lens. It's rare, but I'm sure it's happened often enough. And if it's like, if there's a risk of bleeding inside your eyeball, that, I mean, there's certainly a risk from bleeding inside your eyeball from the surgery. So if there's a risk of bleeding inside your eyeball from this thing floating around, but as far as I understand them, they're pretty blunt and they're not sharp edged. And there may not be much risk of just letting it kind of sit there and rock around on the back and bottom of your eyeball. Gravity is going to keep it in the back. Probably not going to damage anything.
I give credit to my doctor for saying that he doesn't like doing that operation, and he came up with that. And I'm going, really?
Well, what do you care about? You care about being able to see.
Yes, I do. Okay. Can you do one more?
Sure.
Okay. My brother is a disabled vet, got Parkinson's, and his knee's about to go. Is a disabled Vietnam vet.
Uh-huh.
So we're talking old.
Old.
And so he's heard about nanotechnology, and, you know, VA will not pay for that.
We're talking about, like, stem cell injections.
We're talking about his knee and fixing the knee.
Right, I understand, but what was the tech? I mean, nanotechnology to fix the knee sounds a little urban legend-y at this in 2024.
That's what I thought too.
Yeah, but
and
I'm sure there's someone who will sell him an injection and tell him it's nanobots.
yes, and I looked it up, and they do have it, and you know, he doesn't have the $14,000 to do it. I'm going, and they said, but even when you look it up on the net, it says you should be in good shape and you should be able to do this. And but he's looking for, well, I'll have a 2-week recovery. And I have a friend of mine who just had the regular surgery for his knee, and it took 4 months of physical therapy.
You know, some people do have a 2-week recovery from a knee replacement, but I would not bet on it being easy for a Parkinson's patient to recover from it.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, you know, has he gone through the steroid injections and all of that?
No.
Okay.
No, he hasn't done anything.
Right.
Like
so
yet.
Let's start with the most conservative thing, which would be hyaluronic acid injections. That's called Synovisc. It's basically like when you get your lube job and you put, well, people used to get them. I don't know if with modern cars you get them anymore, but you know, they would put this thick viscous grease into the things that had to move to keep them from rubbing against each other. And that's basically what we're doing. We're taking a biological compound that's very gooey and throwing it into the knee. That can be very transformational. Steroids can be very transformational. And this is like you go to the office and they stick a needle in your knee and put something in it. It hurts for a day or two and then you're better. So that could be first thing before you jump to even thinking about a knee replacement, or certainly before you go to either stem cells or, there's all this stuff. The Buffy coat of platelets. I actually like platelet-rich plasma as a therapy for knees. It's not something I do myself.
Nekapa, yes.
But I think it's actually a decent anti-inflammatory agent. And a lot of times with arthritis, I see x-rays of people who are walking around and they've got a limp, but they aren't in pain, and they've got bone on bone. And I see other people, they've got, you know, they still got 2 millimeters of cartilage, and they're in terrible pain because they're on fire. The inflammation is what makes the pain. Sometimes you can, you know, you can eke these things out conservatively, but Parkinson's is a tough disease to rehab with.
It's really tough.
It'll be very tough. I can understand wanting to drop the $14,000 for magic, but right now I think it's a con.
Yeah.
All right. I got to go, but thank you.
You know how he knew it? He saw it on TV.
Oh, well, we know it must be true. All right. Yeah. Bye-bye, James.
Okay, Dr. Don.
Keep listening here on Thursdays at 6 p.m. Okay.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Hello, this is Dr. Don, and you're on the air.
Hello, Dr. Don. This is day two of a weird one-day, two-day deal.
Okay, what's the story?
All right, so yesterday I was going about my business, everything is cool, and then at some point I couldn't swallow anything, including water. I was, however, spitting out. Now, I don't know where that fluid came from, but I thought, this is weird, and that was at 1:30 in the afternoon. I pointed this out. I couldn't swallow anything. Well, I better go in and, you know, maybe my throat muscles are tense. So I tried to swallow. No, water didn't go down. Food hadn't. I had just had a very, very sparse thing. That came up, bits and pieces. The stuff coming up was worrisome. I thought, well, this is bits and pieces. I didn't digest it. Maybe I grounded that far. Anyway, so all the way till, let's see, it was a 10-hour thing. So 11:30 last night, I couldn't swallow food. I couldn't swallow water and medications. Nothing was going down. And as if I were beginning to throw up but not achieving it. And I remember when I threw up long, long time ago when I was younger. I can't remember how that felt. But, okay, it was a pain. Now, my body was probably wanting water, fluid. We're all told about the 8 days or 8 glasses a day. Yeah. I couldn't get any water down. This began to bother me. So I went to bed, and then I started having a strange pain in what I think is my left kidney in that area. And I thought, well, it's being starved for water. It needs water now, which made me think, well, do people who are in dire need in the desert or without access to water, what happens to their kidneys? This pain was throbbing all night, very, very worrisome. I thought, well, maybe I have a kidney stone. I got maybe a total of 2 hours of sleep altogether. Woke up the next morning, had all my medications and stuff to read, ready to go to the hospital. And then I know, well, what happened to that pain in my kidneys? Well, hey, I need some water. So I tried a little water, and it went down.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's after all night long, not all night long, but, you know, these 4, 5, 6 hours of attempted sleep, I had a little bowl near me so I could spit up what was coming up. And I was fluid. And I thought, are these my gastric fluids? Where's this water? I didn't get any water down, so where's this water coming from?
Well, I can answer that one for you.
Yeah.
We put, at a constant level, fluid from our bloodstream into our gut. And we actually need to be drinking because some of that fluid leaves as urine, right? So you want to be in. But in order to digest food, I think the data is that, if I'm not getting the statistic incorrect, I'm close. It might be half. It might be a half. It might be a third. It might be a half. But in 24 hours, we actually recycle like somewhere between a third and a half of our total blood volume through the gut, between the saliva and the secretions and the lubrication and the digestive process. So we're like one of those recirculating fountains. And so what you were coughing up was the stuff that was coming out of the walls of the esophagus. And it was just doing what it's supposed to do, which is leaking in and getting and going down. And so, like I said, we're a recirculating fountain. And so the pump was still going, right? That's the heart.
Uh-huh.
And you were still, you know, exuding the fluid, and it could not get down. Now, that is worrisome, and you absolutely need to get an endoscopy. Somebody needs to look down there and see what happened, why you blocked.
And since then, I've been all right to be able to swallow food, do all that stuff, but still, that gets me thinking, besides the worries about a kidney stone, I didn't see any blood in this one. This fluid is sort of plasma or whatever it was. It was, you know, it was a mixture of not water, but it was watery, of course.
Yeah.
So, and why did it go away? And
I think you had spasm. So
spasm.
I'm worried you have something that's either pushing on the esophagus or growing in it, and it needs to be checked right away. Okay, because if you go, I mean, I once swallowed a rather large Werther's buttercream, and it got stuck in my chest, and it was it's this very, very uncomfortable sensation, a sort of squeezy weirdness, And it does refer to the back. So what you thought was kidney pain may have been referred pain from the esophagus, because it'll do that, like when you hit your elbow and your pinky hurts.
Yeah.
So you can get referred pain.
Oh, no.
And so it may not have had anything to do with your kidney being starved of water, although I'm sure your kidney was. Basically, we have some adaptive responses. Our kidneys are capable of turning down the holes in the filter and putting out very, very little urine if they have to. And they figure out that soon enough in most situations. But people who get good at just drinking small amounts of water can get by on remarkably little if they work if they work their way down. But in your situation here, I don't know what was going on. I really don't like it. And you need the services of gastroenterologists to actually go down there with a periscope and take a look.
Okay. Well, is that going to be a submarine periscope? I can't handle that. That's too big.
It's flexible and tiny. It's the size of your pinky finger. I swear to God.
So this is a
gastroenterologist, GI specialist. You have a primary care doctor.
Yeah.
Go to your primary care doctor. Tell him what happened, or send him an email, or however it is that you communicate with him, or talk to his AI. I don't know. But anyway, get the message across that you had this very unusual, could not take any fluid, could not swallow anything for, at least for 11 hours and maybe overnight, and then you were suddenly okay in the morning, and you talked to a doctor friend who said that she thought you needed to have an endoscopy, and so could he or she please refer you for that?
Okay.
And that's enough of a history that probably they won't make you come in. You know, unless their corporate masters demand it to get the fee. But whatever. Sorry, I'm a little cynical about it.
I am too. You're talking to the right guy.
So, I feel bad because these are good people trapped in a bad system.
Yes, and I'm glad you have that compassion.
It's like, well, hell, I've been there. You know, and it's. But anyway, let's get back to you. You need to get this checked out. Will you promise me to do that?
How imperative,
let me repeat that. You need to get this checked out. Will you promise me to get it?
Well, yeah.
Okay, good. Thank you. How imperative is it? Well, we don't know when and if it'll happen again. So,
right.
And you can't think of any triggers, but I would chew my food really well.
Yeah.
And not, and make sure that you are in the room with your mouth while you're eating and not distracted.
Yeah.
And, you know, attend to your swallow, chew your food well,
sure.
You know, all that stuff, so that you're not sending, you know, any kind of clumps down, so to speak.
Yeah.
Don't send clumps through there. At the minimum, what you've got is an area that's on a hair trigger and went into spasm for, you know, no apparent reason. And you don't want to do that again because it was no fun.
All right. Well, you know, I hear about all these physicians around the world doing stuff for free in their home countries, or the ones in Gaza or Yemen or wherever they're doing it, I just say, that's the Hippocratic Oath. Well, these corporations, they want to end on everything. They want the bottom line. They want their investors paid off. They want the bigger buildings. And you're in that group. You're the ones who just gives advice free and analyze what you can. That's way better than the guys who show up every morning.
You know, that's the thing. We should never have let corporate America, which has no heart and has no soul, and is only, a corporation by definition is sociopathic. It does not have mirror neurons. It does not feel guilty for firing people or treating them in an inhuman way. It just wants to make money. And it tells itself, you know, the head honchos tell themselves, well, I have this fiduciary responsibility to return stockholder value, and I will be, I don't know, burnt at the stake or something. You know, they'll be given a golden parachute and kicked out the door is all. And so, but they, you know, that's their rationalization, you know.
And every time I walk down the street, I meet people and I think, well, which one of these is Citizens United, a full-on corporation walking around? And it just doesn't work because they're human beings, I think, not corporations.
Yeah, they actually have a conscience. And the ones that don't have a pathology.
Yep,
but unfortunately, We've made a real mess of American medicine.
Let's just put it that way. 1970s or 80s?
Yeah. Oh, well, no, it was 1988. It was called the Knox-Keene Act. It was signed by Ronald Reagan as one of his last acts in office. And what it did was it basically allowed for the corporate practice of medicine, which had previously been forbidden by statute.
Really?
Yes.
This is way in the Knox, K-N-O-X?
K-N-O-X and hyphen K-E-E-N-E.
K-E-E-N-E.
Knox-Keene Act.
Oh, wow.
Read it and weep, my friend. Read it and weep.
Ah, jeez.
All right. Well, good night.
Thank you very much for that.
Thank you for promising Dr. Dawn, okay? So you have to keep your promise now.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. You are listening to KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQT Prunedale, 89.5, 89.7, and 90.7, plus KSQD.org. What more could you ask for? I'm going to read just a quick letter that I got. I don't get many letters anymore. This one has a nice smile with a tiger, and it comes from Craig in Santa Cruz. Craig writes, I was glad to hear your medical info. I hope you can help me with diet and exercise program. I look forward to your info. I'm a borderline diabetic and overweight. Craig called in last week after the show was over, but I picked up the call and we had a nice conversation about what I call the cardiometabolic diet, which also works to bring down cholesterol. And would you believe it's a diet that it concentrates on fruits and vegetables. It's about 80% plant. You're allowed plenty of lean protein and also lots of legumes, peas, beans, soy. Those turn out to have also extremely good properties for our friend, the microbiome. So let's see. I'm going to talk a little bit about cancer prevention. We've really got to rethink this insurance thing because they have their rules, right? And one of their rules right now is that they pay for colonoscopies at the age that the U.S. Preventative Health Service Task Force, a very conservative body, very science-based, and in order to be recommended, there's a high bar. It's not like this might work. It's like this has been proven to work in multiple studies and blah-de-blah. I'm not saying I have nothing against scientific rigor, but I am saying when insurance companies use it as an excuse not to pay for something that a doctor who signed the Hippocratic Oath thinks is necessary, you might want to think twice about letting that be the standard of medical care. Anyway, moving on. Colorectal cancer is increasing drastically among young adults. They're becoming actually increasingly common. There was a study that came out of the Netherlands in 2019, and it said that over the past decade, this was looking at the entire EU, the incidence of colorectal cancer had increased by 8% per year among people in their 20s. Now, I'm sorry, that's just crazy. People in their 20s who don't have Lynch syndrome or some other genetic abnormality don't get colon cancer. Well, I'll have to rephrase that. Didn't used to get colon cancer. Now it's becoming a thing. It's up 5% for people in their 30s and 1.6% for people in their 40s. So it's really in the younger people that we're seeing this jump. And the problem is younger people don't know about the symptoms of colon cancer. They don't think they can get it. They often aren't fully insured. And they're less likely to have a regular relationship with a doctor because, hey, you know, they don't get sick very often. And many insurance companies won't pay for a colonoscopy or a diagnostic procedure, particularly. And by the way, they classify them as screening and diagnostic. And ironically, if you have symptoms that might suggest cancer and you get a diagnostic colonoscopy, you're more likely to be charged more than a screening colonoscopy. Why do you ask that the person who might have cancer and really needs this is charged more? Well, the answer is a loophole in Obamacare that basically mandated the coverage of certain preventative services, but forgot to mandate that the real preventative service, which is to, you know, is to find the cancer that's actually there, involves also testing people who are bleeding or otherwise experiencing symptoms that might be suggestive of cancer. Because of these factors, younger people's cancers tend to be found older. In fact, in one study, people under 50 were more likely to have serious stages of cancer. In fact, often not diagnosed before stage 3 or stage 4, and that's after the cancer has gotten out of the bowel. It's much harder to treat. Colorectal cancer is the leading cause of cancer death for men under 50. The third for women under 50. This is just weird, and it's happened very recently. It can't be genetic changes in the population, and it's happened over the last 3 to 4 decades. So we have to think about what are the environmental factors. Not only what are the environmental factors, but what can we do about them to reduce our risk? And people over 50, colon cancer has actually been declining, and that's tracking very nicely with the decline in smoking. Other factors, obesity, lack of exercise, are very much common contributors to colon cancer risk. But a lot of younger people, the doctor, they may even go to the doctor and the doctor says, well, this looks like irritable bowel, because they aren't even thinking that this 30-year-old in front of them could possibly have colon cancer. So what's going on? Well, in my opinion, and I'm not alone in this, lack of fiber in the diet is probably a big factor, because we are letting stuff sit in there longer, and fiber supports a healthy microbiome, and we have introduced a ton of antibiotics into the environment. They are treatments in feedlots, so if you're not eating organic beef, organic chicken, organic everything, which is expensive, and when you eat out, you can't get it, really, you're getting antibiotics as a side order along with your steak. And it also has gotten into the water table. It's gotten into the rivers. It gets gotten into the freshwater fish. And that's just antibiotics, also hormones, right? And some of these hormones are growth hormones because they're given to animals to make them grow, but they can also make tumors grow. So diet is probably a big factor. Recently, the National Cancer Institute pointed out that certain types of bacteria in the gut are known accomplices in the growth and spread of colorectal cancer. Some of them may even affect how certain cancer treatments work by helping the colon cancer get rid of the chemotherapy agent. It's called efflux, and certain bacteria actually assist cells with efflux. Some bacteria toxins cause inflammation. Inflammation is a risk factor for colon cancer. Certain gut bacteria can recruit immune cells that actually help cancers grow and block immune cells that fight cancer. And of course, inflammation creates chemicals that can mutate DNA. So we're caught in this bad neighborhood of our gut if we aren't careful. It turns out that half of the younger people who get colorectal cancer also have a chronic condition that can cause inflammation in the gut. For example, prediabetes or diabetes. Fiber is really key. Eating more fiber, supplementing with fiber, root vegetable every day, taking a probiotic, eating fermented foods, these are all things that you can do to lower your risk of colon cancer. You can go to the supermarket right now and you can pick up a anti-cancer treatment regimen for under 10 bucks that will last you for a week. Well, that would be a big tub of yogurt and some cabbage, because if you eat sauerkraut and eat yogurt, you're getting probiotics, and at least in the case of the sauerkraut, you're also getting fiber. Our environment actually has lots of chemicals in it. This is not news to you, but there are 18 identified chemicals in our environment that cause cancer in the intestines of mice. Also, heavy metals. Those of you who have mercury amalgams have heavy metals kind of raining into your gut all the time, every time you chew foods. Don't just go and get those all drilled out, because that will give you a big burst of metal. That is not healthy. That's not what I'm suggesting. But over time, replacing those with other materials is a good idea. And if you have occupational exposure to lead or mercury or cadmium, those are good reasons to get yourself tested. Another big deal for colon cancer and other cancers as well is sleep. And part of our environmental change for in people younger than 50, they don't have good sleep habits. They have increased screen time, irregular hours. They're working the night shift. They're working the gig economy. They're turning on their phone if they can't sleep. And so they are not getting that deep restorative sleep. And this is really important in reducing inflammation. So recently, I think I reported on this last year, researchers from Cal Irvine found that they could disrupt the circadian clocks of mice and organoids and accelerate the progression of colon cancer. So this is like real good old-fashioned medical advice, right? Eat right, exercise, get some sleep, have a good regular cycle. We have to use rocket science that prove that it's true, but this is common sense. And we should all be doing these things, and we should be teaching our children to do these things, because what we are seeing is that the younger people are going to die in larger and larger numbers from cancer unless we change the food environment and the habit environment of their lives. And I think that would be just a damn shame. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.